Today on the 21st show, Abraham Lincoln GPT. We'll have a conversation with the 16th President of the United States, as interpreted by the AI language model GPT-4. We'll cover his early life in Illinois, his evolving views on slavery, and what he would think of his status as a secular saint of American politics.
The true strength of our nation lies in its people and their commitment to justice, liberty, and equality for all.
Plus, we'll ask a Lincoln historian to critique AI's version of Honest Abe. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL Urbana, WUIS Springfield, WGLT Normal, WCBU Peoria, WNIJ DeKalb, WVIK Quad Cities, and WSIU Carbondale. Now news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today I have the honor of interviewing Abraham Lincoln. Born 1809 in Kentucky, died 1865 in Washington, D.C., Lincoln was, as you know, the 16th President of the United States. Of course, I'm not really going to be talking with Lincoln. Rather, this is a conversation I conducted with the AI language model GPT-4. I instructed it to assume the persona of Abraham Lincoln during his lifetime using language reflective of that era. The president's answers will be given voice by Fritz Klein, an actor and public speaker who has traveled the country portraying Lincoln. If you've ever met Lincoln at an event, especially in Springfield, there's a good chance it was Mr. Klein bringing him to life. Last thing I'll say is that what you're going to hear is fairly close to the dialogue that ensued. I made a few edits for the sake of time, also dropped a few questions I later decided were redundant or not all that interesting. Otherwise, this is nearly verbatim what Lincoln GPT had to say. And with that, Mr. President, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you kindly for having me. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm eager to engage in conversation with you about the matters of my time. Please feel free to ask any questions you may have.
So I'd like to begin with your first foray into politics. Why did you decide to run for the Illinois House of Representatives?
When I first sought to enter the political arena, I was driven by a genuine desire to serve the people and contribute to their betterment and that of our great nation. My early experiences as a storekeeper, postmaster, and surveyor in New Salem, Illinois, provided me with valuable insight into the concerns and needs of my fellow citizens. I believe that by running for the Illinois House of Representatives, I could work to address these concerns, promote economic development, and advance the principles of our democratic society.
You lost your first election. Why do you think that is?
Indeed. I was not successful in my first attempt at public office. I reckon several factors contributed to this outcome. My relative obscurity in the political landscape and limited resources, coupled with my lack of experience, might have given the electorate pause. Additionally, I was a newcomer to the New Salem community, having resided there for a short period, which could have affected my ability to garner widespread support. However, I did not let this initial setback deter me from my aspirations, as I firmly believed in the importance of public service and the values I wished to uphold.
While you were in the state legislature, you adopted the free soil ideology. Can you remind our listeners what that was and why that was your view?
The free soil ideology, which I adopted and ardently supported during my time in the Illinois state legislature, was rooted in the conviction that the territories newly acquired by the United States should remain free from the institution of slavery. This stance was not merely a moral position against the expansion of slavery, but also a reflection of economic concerns for many Americans, particularly those in the North and the West. They believed that the extension of slavery into these territories would undermine the opportunity for free laborers to own and prosper on their own merits. My advocacy for the free soil position was driven by a deep belief in the principles of liberty and equality enshrined in our nation's founding documents. I held that the expansion of slavery would not only perpetuate an egregious moral wrong, but also contradict the promise of freedom and opportunity for all. This belief was a cornerstone of my political philosophy, guiding my actions and speeches throughout my career, including my debates with Senator Douglas and my eventual presidency. The free soil ideology was pivotal in the shaping of the Republican Party's platform and was a precursor to the most encompassing struggle against slavery that would define my presidency.
But wait a minute. With respect, free soil also meant opposing the abolition of slavery, did it not? And you supported a plan to have freed slaves go back to Africa and settle in Liberia.
Well, your inquiry touches on a complex aspect of my political positions and the broader discourse on slavery and racial issues in my time. It's important to clarify these points for a proper understanding. The free soil movement, indeed, primarily focused on preventing the expansion of slavery into new territory and states. This position did not necessarily equate to advocating for immediate abolition everywhere within the United States. Many free soilers were more concerned with the economic implications of slavery's expansion and the moral wrong it represented, rather than pushing for its outright abolition in states where it was already established. The distinction lies in the belief that containing slavery would eventually lead to its ultimate demise. Now, regarding the colonization of freed African Americans, it's true that I once supported the idea of voluntary colonization. I considered it a potential solution to the deep-seated racial prejudices of the time and the challenges of integrating freed slaves into American society. The notion of resettling free slaves in places like Liberia was part of a broader colonization effort that predated my presidency. However, my views evolved, particularly as the Civil War progressed, and the pressing moral and practical imperatives of ending slavery became increasingly clear. My support for the Emancipation Proclamation and the eventual passage of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery altogether, reflected really a profound shift towards the belief that America must confront its original sin of slavery and strive toward a more inclusive vision of freedom. The complexity of these issues underscore the evolving nature of political beliefs in response to the nation's moral and ethical challenges.
I want to skip over your single term in the United States House of Representatives from 1847 to 1849 and talk about your work as a lawyer. One client of yours who's recently become more well-known is a woman named Nance Leggins Costley. What can you tell me about your work representing her?
Well, Nance Leggins Costley's case is indeed a noteworthy aspect of my legal career, and it exemplifies the complexities and moral challenges surrounding the issue of slavery in Illinois, a state where slavery was technically illegal, but where so-called black codes and indentured servitude created conditions that were often indistinguishable from slavery. Nance Leggins Costley, an African-American woman, found herself and her children in a legal struggle for their freedom. In the case known as Bailey versus Cromwell, which came to me in the early 1840s, Nance fought against her and her children's continual servitude under a form of indentured servitude that essentially amounted to slavery. My role in representing Nance Leggins Costley was grounded in the legal argument against the conditions of her servitude, asserting her right to freedom. The case was significant for several reasons, not the least of which was its challenge to the practices that allowed slavery to exist in a state where it was supposed to be outlawed. Winning her case helped to set a precedent that challenged the legal underpinnings of indentured servitude and the broader institution of slavery in Illinois. The victory in Nance Lagan's Cosley's case is a testament to the enduring struggle for justice and the importance of the law as a tool in that struggle. It reflects the complexity of my own views on slavery and race, which were evolving throughout my legal and political career. Representing Nance and securing her family's freedom was an early indication of my growing commitment to the principle that no person should be held in bondage. It is a case that, while perhaps not as well known as other parts of my career, stands as a significant marker of my legal work and my moral compass.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show, and we are speaking with Abraham Lincoln through ChatGPT. We're calling this program Lincoln GPT. Fritz Klein, the noted actor and Lincoln portrayer, is with us giving voice to GPT-4's interpretation of an interview with Abraham Lincoln. Questions by me. Mr. President, in 1858, you campaigned unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate against incumbent Stephen Douglas. The two of you famously debated around Illinois. What did you think of your opponent?
Stephen A. Douglas was a formidable opponent, both in intellect and in political skill. Our views on the pressing issues of the day, most notably on the matter of slavery, were diametrically opposed, which laid the groundwork for our series of debates. Despite our political differences, I had a profound respect for Senator Douglas's abilities as a legislator and as an orator. During our campaign for the United States Senate in 1858, we engaged in 7 debates across Illinois, known today as the Lincoln-Douglas debates. These debates were not just a contest between two individuals, but a profound dialogue on the nature and future of the American Union. Douglas defended the doctrine of popular sovereignty, the idea that the settlers of a territory had the right to decide for themselves whether slavery would be allowed within their borders. In contrast, I argued that slavery was a moral, social, political wrong that should not be allowed to spread to new territories. While I recognized Douglas's talent in swaying an audience and admired his dedication to his beliefs, I fundamentally disagreed with his stance on slavery and believed it contradicted the moral fiber of our nation. Our debates highlighted the deep divisions within our country and foreshadowed the national crisis that would soon follow. Despite losing the Senate race to Douglas, the debates propelled me into the national stage and laid the groundwork for my presidential campaign in 1860. In summary, while I thought highly of Stephen Douglas as an opponent, our ideological differences, particularly regarding slavery and the Union's future, were stark and irreconcilable. These debates underscored the ideological battle that was tearing our nation apart, setting the stage for the tumultuous years that would follow.
It was during this campaign that you gave your famous House Divided speech. Talk about what inspired you to use that phrase and what message you were trying to communicate.
In the House Divided speech, which I delivered upon accepting the Illinois Republican Party's nomination for the United States Senate, June of 1858, it was inspired by a passage from the Bible, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." This phrase, which is found in the Synoptic Gospels, encapsulated my deep concern for the nation's future amidst the growing divide over slavery. The core message of the House Divided speech was a warning that the United States could not endure permanently half slave and half free. I argued that the nation would eventually become all one thing or all the other. This speech was an explicit acknowledgment that the conflict over slavery was fundamental and irreconcilable, threatening the very survival of the Union. My intention was not to advocate for
immediate abolition in states where slavery already existed, but to oppose the further extension of slavery into new territories and states, thereby putting it on a path to ultimate extinction. The speech was bold and controversial, drawing criticisms, even from some within my own party who feared it was too radical and would alienate potential supporters. However, I believed it was essential to articulate the moral and political crisis facing the nation with clarity and conviction. The House-divided speech laid bare the existential threat posed by the division over slavery and called for a decision on whether the United States would live up to the principles of liberty and equality upon which it was founded. This speech was a pivotal moment in my career and in the antebellum political landscape, emphasizing the urgent need for a resolution to the slavery question. It highlighted the stark choice facing the nation and contributed to the deepening national discourse on slavery, on democracy, and on the future of the nation.
All right, we need to take a break on the program. When we come back, more from my interview with Abraham Lincoln, GPT, of course. This is an AI language model instructed to inhabit the 16th president of the United States. It's being given voice by the actor and longtime Lincoln portrayer Fritz Klein. We recorded this last week. One minor correction, I said in a question to Lincoln GPT that he adopted the free soil ideology during a term in the state legislature. It was, in fact, in the Congress when he was serving from 1847 to 1849 that he took up with that ideology. And it's interesting that ChatGPT did not call me on that and just went with it. And at the end of this conversation, we'll hear a little more from Lincoln GPT after the break. And then after that, we will talk with a Lincoln historian, as well as Mr. Klein, breaking down how ChatGPT did, what it got right, and maybe what it failed to capture about the 16th president. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show. Stay with us.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my interview with Abraham Lincoln. As I mentioned earlier, this is actually a dialogue between myself and the AI language model called GPT-4. The president's answers are being given voice by the Springfield-based actor and renowned Lincoln interpreter Fritz Klein. Mr. President, even today, people still invoke the metaphor of the house divided. Recently, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Springfield used it to talk about the division in America over the issue of abortion. What do you think of the fact that people are still invoking your famous use of that phrase?
Well, if I were to reflect on the enduring legacy of the house divided metaphor, I would consider it a testament to the timeless nature of the principles it represents. The issues and challenges facing society may evolve, but the fundamental conflict between opposing moral and ethical visions remains a constant through history. The fact that people continue to invoke this phrase indicates its profound impact and the relevance of its message in addressing deep societal divisions. The use of the house-divided metaphor in contemporary discourse, such as the division over the issue of abortion mentioned by the Roman Catholic Bishop of Springfield, underscores the capacity of this phrase to articulate the essence of conflict and the imperative for resolution. It speaks to the universality of the struggle to reconcile deeply held beliefs within a society, and the ongoing effort to find a path forward that honors the foundational principles of justice, equality, and unity. It is both humbling and affirming to know that my words have resonated through the ages, serving as a call to action and reflection for future generations facing their own pivotal moments. The persistence of the house divided metaphor in public discourse is a reminder of the power of language to capture the human condition and the importance of leadership that seeks to bridge divides and forge a more perfect union. The continued relevance of this metaphor also invites a contemplation of the nature of democracy and the challenges inherent in governing a diverse and pluralistic society. It reinforces the idea that the work of building and maintaining a just and unified nation is never complete, requiring constant vigilance, empathy, and a commitment to the common good.
The House Divided speech was one of many for which you are still remembered today. The Gettysburg Address and your second inaugural are widely regarded as among the best political speeches of all time. Given your modest beginnings and self-education, how did you become one of the great orators?
Well, my journey to becoming an orator of some note, as you kindly describe, was indeed rooted in humble beginnings and largely self-directed learning. From an early age, I possessed an insatiable appetite for knowledge, coupled with a keen understanding of the power of language. Despite my limited formal education, I was an avid reader, immersing myself in books whenever and wherever I could find them. This self-education laid the foundation for my skills in communication and rhetoric. Books such as the Bible, Aesop's Fables, Shakespeare's works were not only sources of immense enjoyment, but also invaluable tools for learning the art of storytelling, the rhythm of language, and the persuasive power of speech. These texts, among others, were my teachers, instructing me in the use of metaphor, analogy, narrative structure, elements that would later be hallmarks of my speeches. Moreover, my early experiences in public speaking, from informal debates in New Salem to my service in the Illinois State Legislature and beyond, provided practical opportunities to hone my rhetorical skills. The practice of law, too, was instrumental in this regard. The courtroom was a forum where I learned to argue with clarity, to appeal to both emotion and reason, and to tailor my message to my audience, skills that proved invaluable on the political stage. Perhaps most crucially, my speeches were informed by deeply held beliefs and a moral vision for the country. The sincerity and conviction with which I spoke were born of a genuine desire to address the grave issues of the day, particularly slavery and national unity. My aim was not merely to persuade, but to appeal to the better angels of our nature, to articulate a vision for America that was both honest about its flaws and hopeful about its capacity for renewal. In essence, my development into the orator you reference was the product of a lifelong commitment to learning, a deep engagement with the critical issues of my time, and a profound belief in the power of words to inspire change. It's a reminder that great oratory is not merely a matter of technique, but substance, having something truly important to say, and a genuine desire to connect with one's audience on matters of profound significance.
You were also known to have a wicked sense of humor. Can you tell us a short joke?
Well, certainly. I've always believed that a good sense of humor is vital, especially in times of great difficulty. Well, here's a lighthearted jest that I might have appreciated. Why do I never play hide-and-seek with mountains?
I don't know.
Because they're always peeking. Humor, in its many forms, served not only as relief from the weight of my responsibilities, but also a means to connect with people, to humanize the office I held, to remind us all of the common humanity we share, even in the midst of our nation's great trials.
Would it be asking too much for another?
No, not at all. I'm happy to oblige. Oh, here's another jest. I might have enjoyed this one. How many ears does Daniel Boone have?
tree. A right ear, a left ear, and a wild front ear. I find a bit of humor can be salve in trying times, and it's always a pleasure to just share a laugh.
All right, thank you for that. While we're talking about more personal matters, may I ask you about your wife, Mary?
Certainly. I would be pleased to speak of Mary. Mary Todd Lincoln, my beloved wife, was a woman of remarkable intellect, strength, and complexity. She hailed from a prominent Kentucky family, was well-educated, possessed a keen interest in politics, rare for a woman of her time. Mary was an invaluable partner to me, offering her unwavering support and counsel through the tumultuous years of my presidency. Our marriage was not without its trials and tribulations, exacerbated by immense pressures of the Civil War and some personal tragedies, including the loss of our sons, Edward, Willie, which deeply affected us both. Mary, in particular, was stricken with profound grief at the loss of our children, a sorrow that I shared deeply. Despite the challenges, Mary's intelligence, wit, determination were sources of strength for me. She was passionate about the Union cause and didn't hesitate to express her opinions on matters of state and politics. Her loyalty to me and to the country was unwavering, even in the face of criticism and personal hardships. Mary's life, both during and after my time, was marked by adversity. Yet she remains a figure of significant historical interest and complexity. Her contributions, sacrifices, and the challenges she faced as First Lady during one of the most trying periods in American history deserve recognition and understanding. Our partnership, with all its joys and sorrows, was a constant in a life and presidency defined by monumental events and profound change.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are continuing our conversation with Lincoln GPT, an interview with Abraham Lincoln as interpreted by the AI language model GPT-4. Mr. President, did you anticipate you would pay the ultimate price for your role in securing the blessings of liberty?
The burden of leadership during such a tumultuous time did indeed cast a long shadow, one filled with myriad threats and dangers. The deep divisions within the country, exacerbated by the war, created an environment where hostility and violence were all too common. While I was acutely aware of the potential dangers that came with the presidency under these circumstances, my focus was steadfastly on the tasks at hand, preserving the Union, abolishing the institution of slavery. The possibility of personal harm, including assassination, was a reality faced by public figures in times of great national strife. However, I did not allow the prospect of danger to deter me from my course. My conviction in the righteousness of our cause and the necessity of the work to be done outweighed personal fears. I felt a profound duty to the nation and its principles, believing that the preservation of the Union and the extension of liberty to all its citizens were worth any risk. Reflecting on the notion of paying the ultimate price, it is my belief that the struggle for liberty and justice is larger than any one individual. The cause for which we fought, ensuring that the United States lived up to its founding ideals, demanded sacrifices, both great and small, from countless individuals. My own fate, while perhaps tragic, is but one part of the larger tapestry of sacrifice woven by those who fought for the Union and for freedom. In the end, if my life was a price that contributed to the securing of the blessings of liberty for future generations, then it was a price I was willing to pay. It is my hope that my efforts
and those of countless others who gave so much in the cause of freedom, would be remembered not for our sakes, but for the sake of those ideals that we fought to uphold.
After your assassination, it became popular to describe Washington as the father and you as the savior. I'm sure the biblical allusion is not lost on you. What would the living Abraham Lincoln have made of your deification?
The likening of my contributions to those of a savior, which undoubtedly well intended as a form of homage, would have sat uncomfortably with me. The use of such biblical allusions, placing me in a role akin to that of a messianic figure, would have been something I approached with considerable humility and perhaps a measure of discomfort. Throughout my life, I was deeply aware of the complexities and fallibilities inherent in human nature, including my own. My leadership during one of the most tumultuous periods in American history was driven by a sense of duty and a deep conviction in the principles of liberty and equality, rather than a desire for personal glorification. The decisions made and actions taken were born out of necessity, guided by the pressing moral and political imperatives of the time, rather than by any aspiration to be remembered as a savior. Moreover, I always believed in the collective endeavor of the American people to shape our nation's destiny. The achievements of my presidency, including the preservation of the Union and the abolition of slavery, were not solely my own, but were the culmination of the efforts of countless individuals who fought, suffered, and even gave their lives for the cause of freedom and justice. To attribute the salvation of the Union to a single individual would be to overlook the sacrifices and contributions of many. The living Abraham Lincoln would have preferred to be remembered as a servant of the people, one who fought to lead the nation through its darkest hours with a sense of moral clarity and a commitment to the principles upon which the United States was founded. The deification of any individual, particularly in the context of a democratic society, runs counter to the ideals of collective responsibility and civic engagement. Those are essential to the health and vitality of the Republic. In essence, while appreciating the sentiment behind such characterizations, I would have urged a focus on the ideals and principles for which we fought, rather than on the elevation of any one individual. The true strength of our nation lies in its people and their commitment to justice, liberty, and equality for all.
Mr. Lincoln, thank you for speaking with me.
It has been my enduring honor to engage in this conversation with you. Should you ever seek to discuss further or inquire about any other matters, know that the legacy and ideals I endeavored to uphold are a testament to the enduring spirit of our great nation. May the pursuit of justice, liberty, and unity guide us all. Thank you, and may the blessings of freedom and equality illuminate our path forward.
And that was my conversation with Abraham Lincoln, GPT, the GPT-4 AI language model channeling the 16th president, given voice by the actor and longtime Lincoln portrayer Fritz Klein. Coming up after the break, we're going to be speaking with Fritz as well as the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum's Lincoln historian, Christian McWhorter, about how ChatGPT did. Did it make any factual mistakes about Abraham Lincoln? Did it capture anything about his personality and the way he might have actually spoken? That's all coming up after a short break. I should say we taped this program last week, so we're not taking calls today, but we'd love to hear your thoughts. Email us anytime, talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. More to come on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We've concluded my interview with Abraham Lincoln GPT, and I want to now spend the rest of the program talking through how GPT-4 did in bringing the 16th president to life. For that, we're going to continue with actor Fritz Klein, who has performed as Lincoln countless times in Springfield and across America for many, many years. And we're going to add Christian McWhorter, who's the Lincoln historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, who has been patiently listening in, furiously scribbling notes this whole time. Fritz, as Fritz and Christian, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be here.
All right. So each of you, first impressions. Christian, I'll begin with you.
I mean, I'm going to try real hard in this not to be too negative, but the main takeaway for me, I mean, I have a number of them, but the biggest one is this doesn't sound anything like Abraham Lincoln. We can get into the nuts and bolts of what Lincoln said and how accurate or inaccurate or useful or not useful it was. But the crux of what you did compared to maybe some other exercises, including exercises we've done at the Presidential Library, the crux of what you did that was different is that you had it be Lincoln. You had it try to embody Lincoln. And
it used words like ardently and reckon. Doesn't that count for something?
I did. I circled reckon.
I noticed that, but that was good.
Yeah. It made little stabs, but it really couldn't keep it up. I would certainly give it an F for, and it rambled, which Lincoln didn't really do. So my first takeaway is it doesn't sound anything like it.
All right. Fritz, what about you? You've studied Lincoln extensively. What did you think?
Well, I would agree with those things. The length of the responses was very uncharacteristic. Now, I'll have to confess that I was speaking this the first time I read it, and I hadn't had any chance to make any markings on the script or anything. So I was focusing a lot more on trying to read ahead and do voice inflections that were not only appropriate, but give some variety to the whole rendition. The language was not 19th century by any stretch of the imagination. There were a few words you threw in that were nice, like reckon. But as a performer, I found early on that 19th century language, choice of words, I have to moderate that for modern audiences. Mm. Some of the words that Lincoln used commonly don't even mean the same thing anymore. And our literacy rate is just so different now than it was. Even a fourth grade level is a stretch in some places. So Lincoln, in his day, was known as a pretty plain speaker.
I wondered about that because I've been reading. Listeners will be tired of hearing me reference this, but I was reading Grant's memoirs, and now I've moved on to Horace Porter's, one of his staff officers campaigning with Grant. Right. And you read when he supposedly quotes Grant, it's very, I shall now awaken and consume breakfast, or something. It's very formal. What do we know about how people actually spoke? How do you learn to channel someone from that time where there's no tape recordings?
Well, going through his own, I've studied his works for a long time. So you get a feel for the language by doing that and what not to use and what will not go over. Initially, I would only use Lincoln's words, and it didn't take very long before I realized I'm not communicating. There's no point if you're not communicating as an actor. So I started modifying, moderating, paraphrasing, and I do much more paraphrasing now, even though it's based on Lincoln's words and thoughts. I probably more often than not, I paraphrase now because of that difficulty.
To make it understandable.
To make it understandable,
Yeah.
I like to couch it in corny, folk-sounding words, put on a little bit of a Southern accent and modulate my voice a bit so it sounds authentic.
but I expected ChatGPT to do that, and it didn't, right? And so, especially in some cases, I mean, Fritz is right that sometimes Lincoln is hard to understand, but a lot of times Lincoln's very easy to understand, too.
Oh, yeah.
And there were several moments throughout this interview where if Lincoln had just answered with his actual answer, because in a lot of cases we have what Lincoln would have actually said, it would have been a much better answer. And it's very interesting to me that it worked so hard to, I mean, not even paraphrase him sometimes, but even when it did, like it would just kind of freak out and it wouldn't really get it right. And there's a lot of times I struggle, I'm just like, why don't they just say what Lincoln really said here?
I'll actually insert the clip. we edited this out of the main interview, but when I asked about Mary Todd, here's what you had to say with your own channeling of what you think Lincoln would have said. While we're talking about more personal matters, may I ask you about your wife, Mary?
It depends on what you ask.
See? That's a better Lincoln answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe it.
Fritz gets it.
I'll go.
Talk about that. Why did you answer that way when GPT was so much more formal and stilted?
You know, she was very well. What this required me to say was that she was very helpful to him during the war, and that's not so true. She was almost more of a liability during the war. She was helpful in many ways. Dressed up the White House, that improved morale. She was the mom, but that was more true of her in the Illinois years. Wouldn't you agree? Mm-hmm. And I have been, that comes out of my experience as Lincoln, as an actor performing in character, doing Q&A. People will say, "Was your wife really crazy?" As an actor portraying Lincoln, I'll say, "Sir, that's an offensive. I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm not going to answer you about my wife." So I'll take that tact. Then afterwards, when I'm not in character, I'll say, "It's a perfectly legitimate question." But remember, Lincoln would not have liked that kind of a question, you know.
Right.
So that's why I said that to you.
Yeah, no, that, and I had hoped that the GPT would be able to do some of that.
Yeah, because you got it something deeper with Lincoln there too by saying that. I mean, first of all, I want to point out too, he would never have called her Mary Todd Lincoln.
No.
She never called herself that. He never called her that. He would never have said
in
that.
In fact, that was a sort of a lost cause revision, right? To add the Todd.
It happens for various reasons, yes, most of them political. Also to distinguish her from Robert's wife, Mary Harlan Lincoln, it's because they're both Mary Lincolns. Anyway, there's all kinds of reasons why that became a thing later. It wasn't in Lincoln's time, and we at the museum always call her Mary Lincoln because that's what she would have called herself.
Yeah, yeah.
But
Todd.
The other thing that Fritz was doing was he was making Lincoln funny, right?
Yes.
The other thing that this doesn't do, Lincoln speaks like this is, I almost, I used to teach college, and this, in some ways, this reminded me of like a bad undergraduate paper where they don't really know. They know, like, ChatGPT knows like four things about Lincoln, and it just keeps telling you those things, and it doesn't really understand anything about the guy at all.
Right.
And so, and that's probably an overstatement for this, but like, it's a joke, right? Lincoln isn't like Lincoln. From what we know, if you really look into Lincoln, Lincoln was apparently a lot of fun to be around. He was really he would joke a lot. He would tell these stories, and that's why people liked him. And you get no sense of that at all from this interview.
Well,
there was an overemphasis on the moral element. Now that was clearly there, but some of the political ramifications and practicalities. It mentioned that, but I think in terms of priorities, the moral element was always there. But this kind of makes Lincoln into more of an idealist than, I mean, he was, but I think it tends to make him elevate that element a little too much.
He was trying to get through the day like the rest of us are. He wasn't sitting back thinking deep thoughts about his place in history necessarily, or sort of philosophizing about the underpinnings of his actions morally day to day. I don't know.
Sure. It's also, I think the other thing that's part of that is it again, coming back to the bad undergraduate paper thing, it's very general, right? So for instance, the answer about the debates and the answer about the House Divided speech, which were like back to back, there's a lot of things Lincoln says in both those things and would have said summarizing them where he would have been very specific, right? Like Lincoln had very specific problems with what Douglas was doing. He had very specific problems in the House Divided speech, which what he thought Democrats were doing nationally. The Dred Scott decision never comes up in his answer, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't really like the House Divided speech was a really good example for me where the only thing ChatGPT seems to know about that speech is that he used that metaphor in it. You ask a follow-up question about the metaphor, and again, it just keeps saying like, "Yeah, this is a metaphor," and like that speech is actually, and Lincoln says in his answer, it's really radical. But it wasn't radical because he used that metaphor. It was radical because Lincoln is really spelling out in that speech that he thinks like slaveholders are trying to take over the country by using the Democratic Party to do it. Like, it's a very radical, almost conspiratorial speech. Yeah. Clearly, ChatGPT has no idea what else Lincoln said in that speech except the very beginning, the famous part, right?
And he has what? There's one line in the speech that becomes a sticking point for...
And it was a long speech,
in secession, too. But right about something like the end, the eventual end of slavery or something, that becomes a sticking point.
And that wouldn't have come up in that. That was too explosive.
Yeah.
He had to walk a very fine line. And it also didn't address... the issues around popular sovereignty were not as clear-cut as this makes it seem. Mm. It was a conflict of logic, really, that Lincoln tried to address. How can you say the people can vote it in or vote it out, and then with the and then Douglas basically said they can't, but they can, and that's where Lincoln caught him in the Freeport question. Hmm. You can't say on the one hand that they can do it, but on the other hand they can't. And he also brought up, how's that going to happen? The first 10 people that move in, are they going to do it? Or you know, how is this representative of majority rule? And so there were a lot of other issues besides the ones that they laid out here.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make. Like, Lincoln is a politician, and he's a smart person. So he's not, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, just being like, well, here's the problem, Steve. You know, you think people should be able to vote on it, and I don't. Like, he's pointing out all the reasons Douglas's model won't even work. And again, I talked about how there's no specifics here, and that's actually playing out in Kansas at the time as the whole popular sovereignty idea is falling apart and people are killing each other over it. You know, Lincoln has like a concrete example of, here's why your idea doesn't, you know, the moral part of it is obviously important to Lincoln, but he's also making the point that this won't even work. And again, ChatGPT doesn't pick up on that at all.
Yeah. Okay, just a few minutes left in our time together. Fritz, I wonder what you think about this. This is an early version of this technology. It's going to continue to advance. What do you think about the possibilities of this as a teaching tool?
Well, there's a lot of, I think, positive and negative. I am actually working on some things that would enable not just ChatGPT, but artificial intelligence, the upgrade of holographic imagery as an asset for Springfield. I'm not going to be around for a long time, forever, you know, but there's amazing things that are being done right now. I was just talking in the Holocaust Museum, there's a hologram of a person, I don't know if it was a man or a woman, who survived it and gave testimony of it, and they've now passed away, but that looks like the real person. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're moving towards that. A lot of actors are afraid of that, because why should I hire you and I got your hologram? And that's part of the controversy, but for our purposes as an historic entity here, I think it's wonderful. Mm. We can do amazing things for years to come, as long as we have the integrity to present it historically accurately. I think it's wonderful.
And hopefully at a level higher than a hack undergraduate research paper. Yeah. Christian, what about as a research tool, right? We just saw that story about the scrolls from Pompeii that were deciphered using AI. That's a different thing, a different aspect of this technology. But is there potential for this in the future?
I mean, I think Fritz is right. There's applications for AI in, you know, what we call public history museums and things like that. But I mostly think what we dealt with today and what we do with ChatGPT right now is mostly not particularly helpful for a student or a researcher for a number of reasons. But the biggest one is, you know, this doesn't give you any citations. And so all these programs are essentially doing is combing the internet for information. And A, you know, is it good or bad information? B, is it plagiarizing work that scholars like me have done on this, right? And, you know, that's why it's giving you this simplistic view. And so if this is as far as you go, I think that's problematic because it's not giving you a complete picture. But I'm also not sure it's helping you go any farther because you don't know where to go from this. Like, you know, everybody knows Wikipedia is problematic too, but Wikipedia has citations. You know, I think, and a lot of what this exercise too, because you put it in Lincoln's words, some of the things that are in here are what we call interpretation. we don't really know whether Lincoln did something or he believed something or he didn't. By putting in his words, we're making it fact. And so, like, if a student were to read this, they would be, or hear this, they would be like, oh, well, Lincoln must have done that. And, like, no, that's something that historians have kind of reasoned out. So
yeah.
I think we're a long way away from this being useful right now. Yeah. Sorry to be a downer.
No, that's good. That was the point of this exercise. Well, Fritz Klein, Christian McWhorter, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for participating, and Fritz especially for bringing Lincoln GPT to life.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yep, it was.
And that's all the time we have for today. Special thanks to our partner station, NPR Illinois, WUIS, for letting us use their studio to record this conversation. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.